This is Monocle on Design, a show where we unpack everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. On today's program, we meet the glassblower John Pomp, and the luxury bag designer Marina Raphael joins us in the studio. Plus, we talk to Maxime Diongiac, the architect reinterpreting the Orient Express. All that coming up on Monocle on Design. John Pomp's studio is an artisan manufacturer focused on creating organic works of furniture and lighting. Based in Philadelphia and New York, and led by its namesake founder, the designer, artist and glassblower John Pomp, the studio has a team of over 50 creatives. Together, they design and produce each piece in-house, combining modern techniques and old-world craftsmanship. The resulting work was recently on show at Paris's Triode Gallery. Its exhibition space is dedicated to showcasing some of the best American artists and creatives, which made it the perfect setting for me to talk to John about his creative outlook.
I'm a glassblower of 30 years, so I started and I fell in love with glass when I was like 19, 20 years old. My real path and journey really started in craft and my love and passion for glassblowing itself and the material. I fell in love with the fire. I fell in love with molten glass. I was a fine arts painter when I went to art school under the urging of my mentor. He said, you should try glass. I think it's going to make sense to you. And I was like, nah, okay, yeah, whatever. I'll just try it. I really didn't want to. And a common theme in my life is being everything that I didn't think I was going to be. So fast forward, I touched molten glass, 20 years old, devoted my whole life to it. I just fell in love with it. And at that time, it combined my passions and the things I was in love with at the time. And that was skateboarding and non-representational action painting. Intuitive, in the moment, it's all about time, and it is all process.
That process with the material, it's understanding how to shape it, how to turn it, how to blow it. Walk us through that moment where you're like, okay, this is the process I want to dedicate myself to.
First time I touched it, it just felt like magic. It just felt like electric. It was exhilarating, scary, seductive, beautiful, all those things in one moment. And what can I tell you about the material? To actually get a grasp on it, I had to just dedicate decades of my life to really understand how to use it and craft it and to really become proficient at it. People ask like, oh yeah, what's it like to learn how to blow glass? I kind of talk about it very similarly to like, can you just approach a piano and sit down and play like Mozart? You got to put your hours in, and especially that, and it's an elusive material. It's alive. It has a life of its own, and it has a lot of rules, and you have to understand its nature so you can understand how to have a dialogue with it and really get the most out of it.
I mean, I want to ask, so you go from the glass blowing, you talk about this process and this material that's difficult to tame. How does that then translate into that next layer? I guess we're adding designer there. You've gone from craftsperson to designer. Can you tell us about that evolution?
After spending decades working with glass, moving to New York City and starting my first glassblowing studio in Brooklyn, New York in 1999. And there comes the design part. That's whenever design was just starting to like percolate and bubble up inside of New York City and then ultimately in the United States. And I was at ground zero for it. It was a really wonderful time. The college I went to was the Columbus College of Art and Design. So I have a formal design background. And then fast forward to me moving to New York all those years later, it was contemporary design that really was starting to like blossom in New York City at the time. So it was that next era and phase in my life was really combining design to my love and passion for the material.
Today, we looked at a collection of lights. There's metalwork involved as well in what you mount your glass to. Is there a consistency to your pieces? Because just in terms of like working with a material that is notoriously inconsistent, I guess it's that blurring between craft and design. Because design, to me, there is a structure to it. There is a formality to it. And yet craft,
it's a very nonlinear process. My personality and who I am is I'm filled with like opposites in my life. I'm very diametrically opposed. And like, so part of me is very right brain and part of me is very left brain. So it's kind of cool where I can take linear thinking and straight line design and then go all the way to the other end and just be free and open and gestural and organic. So I think that comes out in our work, which is cool. And I think there's a time where I have to, like, I love the architecture of design and like the linear thinking and controlling. Everything has to have concise intention. And then the other half of me just like throw it out there and just loose and you just let it go and you're just free and you're flowing and you're intuitive and you're in the moment and you're just moving. I try to find this beautiful place where those two things can exist. And that's really a hallmark of all the work that I do.
It's a big part of the work that you do is the fact that you're also inventing your own tools to work with, which in turn allows you to maybe do things that no one else does.
I come from a studio art background, right? So just being a studio artist, the work is very sculptural and it's always about like finding and developing processes, right? When you do all this experimentation and then you come on something that like, and you develop a process that develops a form or a texture or a moment with the material that like sings to you, then you have to figure out how to like really define that process. We talked about it a little bit. Now with a larger team, we have a 65,000 square foot facility and we have like over 50 artists and craftspeople making our pieces. It's really about designing processes, taking that one person studio artist moment and then building upon it to something like bigger and greater. And that includes making our own tools, our own ovens and equipment. I wanted to make everything in my house of glass. So I wanted to make these dining tables, but then how do you make like 12-foot dining tables that weigh 1,500 pounds? I had to build a piece of equipment and I had to like figure out a process that took 3 to 4 years to make and do. And we debuted an amazing like cast glass dining table collection this past year that comprises of like metal and glass, but these glass tables are monolithic. They're huge and they're architectural and they're enormous. And they're things that I've never seen before, but it takes that inventiveness, right? Part of like my love of glass is it's a bit of alchemy. You have to be a bit of an alchemist and you have to invent things and invent processes and invent tools. So I kind of like I really love being able to do that with a large group of like artists and craftspeople. I think that in little ways, some artists, we all kind of find these things we have to invent and create. And so I think I'm just able to like be fortunate enough to like be able to do it on like a bigger scale.
I want to talk about scale. You've got 50 people that you're working with, the scale of your business. How are you ensuring that there's still talented people to work with and how do you retain that talent in a team of 50?
I spent 10 years in New York City, like growing my business and I ended up moving it back to Philadelphia and because I used to teach at the Tyler School of Art. And so something that's really wonderful about Philadelphia is that for a very kind of a modest sized city in America, it has, dare I say, like more art programs per capita than any other city in the United States. So I came back there to be part of that arts and crafts community. And it's a very amazing arts community there. And so I think coming back there to be part of that and also being able to teach people because of my teaching background, how you can find purpose and make things. And I think we all care about where our things come from and how to like all that kind of maker, do it yourself. And I think we're taking that a bit further and being able to like teach and train a lot of artists how to make glass and metal, and we do all kinds of materials, wood and leather now, we do everything, but it's about sharing and education.
Do you see sort of artists as the people that have the potential to preserve craft?
Absolutely, and I don't even know that it's only artists. Like, I'll be honest with you, people are respecting trades differently than they have done decades ago. I hope we all see a little bit more skilled trade schools or it has more respect than it did like 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I think it's not like a general laborer thing. When you make luxury furniture and lighting that's sculptural, that's shown all over the world, like that's highly skilled and there's opportunity there and we're making it.
And I guess just finally, I'm curious, what's next for you and your team? What are the big projects that you're getting excited about, or the big issues you're looking forward to tackling?
We were talking about the studio artist and, you know, where my background and how I came up. Just a year ago, we opened up a 4,000 square foot New York City showroom. And so we show a lot of our collection pieces, but we're planning for a spring show and I'm going to start showing some one-off limited edition works. So really coming full circle to the beginning of my journey and coming back to just being an artist, sculptor, glassmaker, designer.
My thanks to John Pomp there, speaking to me at Triode Gallery in Paris. We're back in London to meet another founder of a namesake brand, Marina Raphael. The 5-year-old label is known for producing luxury handbags that are timeless in style and look. The label's founder, Marina, aimed to build a modern heritage brand with a laser-sharp focus on quality and craftsmanship. To tell us more about this approach, Monocle's fashion director, Natalie Theodosi, caught up with Marina in our studio. She began the chat by sharing how Athens inspires her and the advantages of having a base there.
It's absolutely incredible to have grown up in Greece, and I'm super proud to be Greek. There's so much inspiration, and it's so wonderful to have grown up with such warm, kind-hearted, and welcoming people. I really get inspired by nature. So there's so many beautiful naturally occurring colors, so many textures to be found in nature and the beautiful coastline. Greece has such amazing history, and I love to look at detail. I take these things for granted, just visiting the Acropolis and looking at the different carvings, the textures, the different columns, these architectural lines, these different landmarks. I try to take this inspiration and then use those as part of my designs. I also really believe in the Greek workforce, and we have an amazing team, as my headquarters is based in Greece, an amazing team of young, driven individuals who are just helping to push my vision forward. And combining the Greek team with our global team, we have a team based in New York, in Florence, in London, in Austria.
Going back to sort of your original mission, it's incredible that from a very young age, instead of trying to create something that was necessarily just for people in your age bracket or quite trendy, you set out on a mission. You had laser focus to do something that was quite classic and timeless, and you did create a leather bag that has a very distinct shape, architectural lines, and has become now very recognizable as a classic design. And I think this is something that we talk a lot about on this show. Tell me a little bit about that and your approach to design, what you think makes good design.
Building a strong brand identity and creating a signature silhouette is probably one of the hardest things for a young designer. It's really important to focus on repetition to bring this signature silhouette and get your customers to recognize it, reinventing it in different materials and sizes and reintroducing it to the market, focusing on gradual evolution rather than revolution. Our signature shape is the classic Riviera bag we've brought back in raffia, in canvas, in leather, embellished. It's really about bringing the bag back for me and constantly showing different customers and adapting it to different customer needs. It's really important to solidify all these brand codes and reinforce them. Continue bringing these little elements of architectural lines, angular shapes back into every season. And that's what is really our strong focus for the next 5 years, is continuing enhancing those and making sure our customers are really clear on our brand vision and our direction.
So power of consistency,
exactly,
which I guess is quite rare in the accessories market. We've seen a lot of young brands come and go because they might be influenced by trends, by what's going on social media, and try to jump on those rather than be a little bit more patient and stick to one signature design and build an icon. Let's talk about craft as well, because I know that is something that you've been very specific about from mm-hmm. day one. Why is it so important, especially for a young brand, to maintain such high quality standards? And how did you find the best craftspeople to work with, the best factories, the best artisans?
Craftsmanship is extremely important for me. I want to offer my customers the highest quality standards available, making sure that each seam and stitch is done in perfect detail. It is a quite lengthy process from start to finish, from the sampling process up to the final production and all the quality checks involved in making sure the product is absolutely perfect at the end when it is shipped to our final customer. We first look at an overarching theme of the collection. For spring summer 24, it was MR City. With that theme, we then look at different colors and textures which fit into that theme. And then we start looking at suppliers and where we're able to source these materials in a sustainable and responsible way, making sure we find the highest quality materials to visualize and create the bag. I then travel to a lot of leather fairs like Linea Pelle or Première Vision in Paris to make sure that we know and can monitor all the newest innovations and make sure we have all the suppliers and choose the most relevant one for the materials we are trying to source. We go on to like the sampling process where we create a salpa, which is a type of cardboard replica of the actual bag, just to understand the proportions and the shape. And this is something pretty standard. All our production is handmade in Florence, Italy. Once we approve the salpas of any new shapes we're trying to create, we then go on to creating the pre-production samples, which are used for press and loaning and shoots, which is basically an idea of how the final bag will really look. And then we go on to ordering the bulk production, which we receive after a couple of months. And then there are three quality controls which happen. One in Florence in the factory, just to make sure that the bags are perfect. Then by our core partners, Swarovski in Austria. And then the final third quality check in our warehouses in Athens before they get packaged and shipped to all our customers. So it is a very lengthy process, but this way we can really ensure that the product our final customer receives is absolutely beautiful.
I think it's so interesting that you've explained it from start to finish, because a lot of people in fashion and across the design world speak about complex design supply chains without really giving the customer or the listener a full picture of what does that really mean. And it's clearly a really painstaking process. It requires a lot of effort. Is it a lot harder for you as a younger independent brand to maintain the standards, to find the suppliers and convince them to work with you, especially high-end ones in Florence, if you're competing with the big conglomerates, the big, very established fashion houses?
For me, it's something that is really non-negotiable. So I'm willing to put in the effort and to go above and beyond to make sure that the product is really what I want it to be. There is a lot of competition, and of course, bigger brands have much bigger orders. Of course, all the different suppliers prioritize them. We've really managed to build a really strong supply chain and a really good team, which are involved in making sure every different step is seamless. So I think now I'm really in a good place to expand the brand. We continue growing in terms of volume and in terms of collaboration so quickly throughout the year. We did this incredible collaboration with fine jewelry designer Eugenie Njarchos. Now we have an exciting collaboration coming up with an incredibly talented stylist, Georgia Medley, who I worked with for our Spring Summer 24 campaign. So we have some beautiful bags coming out. It's honestly one of the funnest parts of the job to work with like-minded individuals. It's a very collaborative effort where two people, which have not necessarily aesthetic, but similar attention to detail and what they value in a product, come together and create something so special. It was such an honor working with Giovanna Engelbert, who's the creative director of Swarovski. We created a handbag line for collection 2 years ago. ago, three incredibly spectacular and sparkly bags, which were basically inspired by creating a life-size gem to carry in your hands. I think all these different people bring something fresh and new to make sure that the brand remains current and is just creatively always evolving.
Marina Raphael in conversation with Monocle's fashion director, Natalie Theodosi. Finally on today's show, we meet Maxime Diongiac. The French architect has a portfolio that includes scenography for Hermès and collaborations with the likes of Lanvin. He's also recently been appointed the artistic director of the Orient Express, leading a team that is redesigning the train and creating a new ship, the Orient Express Silences. He joined me in the studio to discuss designing for luxury travel, imbued with respect for tradition and detail.
We reinvent with the spirit of the creator of the trademark. We reinvent a modern product who respect forgotten rules, forgotten history. We put it on the table and they say, but it doesn't exist anymore. No one is working like that. Yes, but no one got the time to work like that. So I asked to have time to draw, to redraw, to do mistake, take some time to do some research. What was the real train in 1920? What was the innovation? How can we manage water, sustainability, electricity, sound for everything? They've got an old train. They rediscover stock between Belarus and Poland.
And you were working on that old train?
And I'm working on that old train.
Still going, ongoing process?
It's complicated because you are working with small artisans and it's an industrial process which is a small scale. But it's really also a market. We have not a lot of luxury train in the world. You are working with people at the scale of a car like Bentley, old Ferrari or old Rolls-Royce, than to work with people refitting planes or things like that. It's an old industry with a new kind of product. It's extremely complicated with the integration of the security of the our century and to try to work in a really small width to be able to have a little living room, private toilets, everything to be able to put away your jacket without hurting the wall.
You've kind of got two things going on here. You're working on that history, but then there's also the actual vessel. It's architecture that's in motion, a train, essentially. Maybe we'll start with the history first. How do you start to address the history of the Orient Express brand in your design?
It was easy because the quantity of archives are enormous. In 1926, they've got more than 14,000 plans only for plate, glasses, forks. So each item was drawn and made for the Compagnie des Wagons-Lits. When you have this kind of details everywhere, be able to think about how to serve mustard, what kind of bucket for champagne, because it's going to move, how are you going to fix it on the table? So it's real design. It's not only a nice bucket or a nice bottle. If you don't know how to put it on the table, which is smallest, because you don't have so much room and it's extremely expensive, you cannot succeed. So we go in the same kind of way of thinking and of drawing. Where I come from, I learn to draw with a real small pen, with small line, extremely precise. When I redraw for that project, I use the same kind of technology that they use at the time. After that, we have 3D, we have everything, because it was impossible to build such a product. But it begins with the same kind of way of thinking and of drawing.
So not even drawing just from the archive. You're drawing inspiration from there, but you're literally drawing in the same way that they drew
exactly.
These originals.
Some people, when they saw all my plans, they cannot say the date. It was the only way to do it. Because on a train, if you do a mistake of 8 millimeters, you are going to broke your toes.
So let's talk a little bit about that. There's a lot of complexity to designing for a
train. Not a lot, only complexity.
There's no simplicity.
No, only complexity. Because the width of the room is 1 meter, 96, 8. It depends on the car. And in that, you have to find the way to sleep well. So vibration, size, glamour, because if you make a voyage with your partner, you need to have this glamorous and this sensual emotion. But before that, there is all the building of that. Where are you going to put the pillow, the four pillow? It's complicated in a train. Where are you going to put the big luggage? Do you need to call a butler to use your luggage? No, you need to be able to use it alone. You are going to have a safe. We don't want TV, but we will have Wi-Fi hidden. Do we want to know the time? Do we need the clock? Yes, no. After that, the view is really important in a room. So we try to work on the inside window. We redesign everything, carpet, motif decoration, and we reinvent a kind of plant, because Orient Express invent something really specific, la grande transformation. It was daytime, you have a small tiny room and you go for dinner, and when you came back you have your room dressed for the night. So it was two atmosphere, and we say if they did it at this time, we need to do something now.
So your room has multiple functions.
Yes, we change one thing because the comfort change. For Orient Express and all the luxury train, it was 10 cabins and one toilet, which could be complicated, because if you are going to the toilet at night, you are going to meet a girl in a corridor of 58 centimeters. If we do something, it has to be really comfortable. So in a car of 21 meters long, we do three suites. So in each suite, you have your toilets, your big shower. It's more than 80 centimeters of diameter. There are a few apartments in Paris or in London who doesn't got that. The grand transformation was, instead to have a tiny room with a tiny bed and a tiny living room and a super tiny bathroom, we say we need a big bathroom. We need to put the toilet in a specific box, and we need to have a big room who change in room and living room. There is a transformation who make two couch in two or one bed in less than 2 minutes by one people. It's extremely technologic. It has to be light, but heavy and not to move during the night. All these items are extremely complicated, but it's real design.
First Orient Express have you in to work on this train, and we're hearing about all that complexity there. But then it evolves into a ship, and you're working the Orient Express Silent Seas yacht. Tell us a little bit about how that project builds on the work that you're doing on the train.
We are not going to import the train in a boat, okay? Because it's not the same scale, it's not the same light, it's not the same story. And I say also, we don't import the train in the hotel if we do an hotel. We import the spirit of Orient Express, the archive, the history, and the way of thinking. Orient Express is not a company who was doing hotel. We are the voyage, and we are part of the trip. We are not only a place where you stay. So for the boat, it was, as for the train, a new vehicle. It's a different way to travel because it's on the sea, and the technical difficulties of the sea is unimaginable. It's extremely complicated. On the train also, the deformations, the vibrations are different, the fire, the water are different, the noise are different. So Accor decide to be also on the market of the cruising.
I want to pick up on something, and you've referenced it throughout, but it's about that ethos of the Orient Express. It's about voyage. It's not about a train. Tell us what that means. What do you mean by the Orient Express brand is about voyage?
Nagelsmacher, the founder and the creator of this trademark, he got really vision of what could be the luxury market now. This guy invent this train, and it was not only a train, it was a way to go from his hotel to his other hotel in Istanbul, the Pera Palace, where Agatha Christie and a lot of people came, in Paris, l'Elysee Palace, a really big hotel in Egypt, everywhere. So it was not only a company of train or hotel, it was something around the travel, the voyage. That's what we are working on. We are not doing only an hotel. We are not a trademark of hotel. We are a trademark of voyage. Orient Express is really magic and so rich.
My thanks to Maxime Diangiac there. And that's all for today's show. For more design stories, listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, Monocle on Design Extra.
which airs on Thursdays. And if you enjoy print, then do pick up a copy of Monocle magazine as well. It's on all good newsstands now. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maylee Evans. I'm Nick Manise, and you can reach me on nm@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.